Have you ever wanted to dive deeper into Scripture? If so, you're in luck, because every day there's a new Scripture reflection from the thoughtful staff at America Media, thinking through big questions together, like, what do Catholics believe about guardian angels? And what can Gen Zers take away from the Gospels? If you're already a subscriber, you can access these reflections in your email inbox or on our website. If you'd like to become a digital subscriber, it's easy to do. Just visit americamagazine.org/subscribe, and you'll have full access to America's Scripture Reflections.
Hello, and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast by the young, hip, and lay editors of America Media. That lay part means we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. Join us each week for a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news, often over drinks. I'm Ashley McKinless, and I'm joined by Zach Davis.
It's great to be with you, Ashley. Happy Memorial Day weekend.
Yes, we had a great weekend, great weather here in New York, and now I feel like we're finally getting to summer.
Summer is so, so close, which means we will be taking a break eventually, but we still have an entire month of great content to bring to you in the podcast feed.
Yeah, some really great guests coming up, including this week with Bishop John Dolan. He's the bishop in Phoenix, and he wrote a really powerful essay for America Magazine. It's titled, A Ministry of Human Fragility: Why I Established a Mental Health Office in the Diocese of Phoenix. Bishop John Dolan has lost loved ones to suicide, so he opens up about that and why he was so passionate about bringing a mental health office to his diocese.
And just want to let everyone know before we get into that interview and that conversation that we do touch on suicide, and want to let people know if you're having thoughts of suicide, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. You can find more resources from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention at www.afsp.org.
And in Signs of the Times this week, we are talking to our friend and colleague, Father James Martin, about a new pastoral reflection from the Vatican on engaging with social media.
Yes, so definitely going to stick around for that. But before we get to that, what's on tap this week?
We are having one of my favorite, Maker's Mark, which was the recommendation of Bishop Dolan.
Have you been to Maker's Mark Distillery?
I haven't. That is on the bucket list.
It's a great place. It's a pilgrimage site of sorts. Got to go there with my dad for his birthday once.
Nice.
So. Love Maker's Mark. So all right. Cheers. Thanks, Bishop Dolan, for the rec. Speaking of social media, the Vatican has this new document that we're going to be unpacking with Father James Martin here in just a second. Maybe that's something you don't feel super comfortable with, or you tend to stick to one platform over the other. Like maybe you're like, I get Instagram, but Twitter is a lost art for me. Don't even mention TikTok. Well, I have great news for you because Wondrium has an incredible course called Social Media 101.
Yeah, and one of the best parts about Wondrium is that all the lectures come from experts in their field. So you know, unlike social media, you're not going to be getting misinformation when you listen to this course. It's all trusted and vetted, and you can listen to it anywhere ad-free.
That's right. And in Social Media 101, they're getting both like the basics of how to use these platforms, but also sort of why they all exist. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, YouTube, TikTok, and more. So you're definitely going to want to check this one out.
We love Wondrium, and we know you will too. So do what we did and sign up today. Right now, Wondrium is offering our listeners a free month.
That's right. To get that offer, you just have to visit our special URL, which is wondrium.com/Jesuitical. That's wondrium.com/Jesuitical. Sign up today and get a free month.
And now it's time for Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we sift through the Catholic news of the week so you don't have to. And this week we're talking to our colleague, Father Jim Martin, about a new document from the Vatican on social media. Welcome back to Jesuitical, Jim.
Great to be here.
And you are obviously like a Catholic social media expert in your own right, but you had a particular involvement based on your role with the Dicastery for Communications, correct?
Yeah, so I'm a consultant to the Dicastery, which is a very, very, very low level of staff in the Vatican. And we were all asked to contribute to this document. So it was a product of many, many people. And they pulled it all together in the end.
Okay. And it's called Toward a Full Presence, a Pastoral Reflection on Engagement with Social Media.
Why did the Vatican want to come out with this document, both in general, but also at this moment?
Well, the Dicastery is very concerned with not only communications from the Vatican, so internal communications, so like the Holy See Press Office, L'Osservatore Romano, all the social media accounts, but they're also concerned with how people use social media and how people communicate within the church. And so what they or we decided was it's really time for a document like this, especially because there's so much, you know, kind of hatred and trolling and all that kind of stuff on Catholic social media. They saw that as a real need.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask about that. Do people at the Vatican actually keep up with Catholic Twitter and what's going on there? They do.
Yeah, totally. So they are, especially in the Dicastery for Communication, you know, where they help out with the Pope's own social media accounts and the Vatican's social media accounts. So they see what's going on. They're very savvy.
Do you get a sense that they're mostly concerned about the United States, or is this a global problem for the church?
Well, the U.S. is a special problem, but it's really a problem all over the place. In fact, I had a conversation with some people a couple of months ago who the Dicastery put me in touch with, this is not secret, who were struggling with how to promote the Vatican's message while they're getting attacked. So, and these were people from all over the world that were suffering from this. And so I think that's one of the goads to them was, you know, they have people that they know who are experiencing this, but also on a more positive way of looking at it. They want to use social media as a way of proclaiming the gospel.
I want to move through some of the major points in the document. And it centers around this comparison to the Good Samaritan, right? Which I thought was very savvy because that's also Pope Francis's technique in Fratelli Tutti. So what does the Good Samaritan have to say about how we use social media?
So it has to say a lot. First of all, you're dealing with someone who you may not know, right? So the Good Samaritan, when he's coming by, the beaten man by the side of the road in Luke's gospel is Jewish and he's a Samaritan, and those groups are generally at odds. And so it's reaching out to people who may be different, who may be seen as other, who you may even see as an enemy. But, you know, one of the things I like to focus on is that the road itself is kind of dangerous. So, you know, as you know, when you go to the Holy Land, you can see the Jericho Road that goes from Jerusalem to Jericho, and it's full of twists and turns, and you could see where robbers would be kind of lying in wait for you. So the Samaritan had to kind of put himself out there and take some risk to help the beaten man. And the same on social media. You know, when you try to reach out to people, when you try to be charitable, when you try to give people the benefit of the doubt, people might attack you. So it is not without risk. And that's one of the aspects I really liked about that story. But, you know, basically, can you be a good Samaritan on social media? That's kind of the sort of a real through line for the document.
And what advice does this document give to users in that regard? Do they have, you know, best practices for tweeting or posting on Instagram?
One of the best practices is, in fact, not seeing a person as an other, right? Seeing the person as a friend, seeing the person as a brother or sister, someone who's in the community, and not treating them as someone who's distant. Also, again, giving people the benefit of the doubt, trying to put yourself in their shoes. They talk about that a couple times in the document. Listening. One of the great things about the document, I think it says that we don't have access to the conversation between the Samaritan and the beaten man. But there's a great question there where they say that the Samaritan must have said, "Hey, what happened to you?" And so it's a kind of invitation for people on social media to try to understand the other person on the other side of the Twitter or Instagram or Facebook account.
Well, I feel like there's this invitation in the document to practice real deep listening, and particularly from people who are just like using social media passively, right? So maybe people who aren't posting all the time and creating content, but your average person who's just like kind of scrolling, there's a chasm between sort of like deep listening, deep engagement, and sort of the mindless scrolling that I do before I go to sleep when I wake up every day. That is, it just feels very fragmented in a way that makes deep listening impossible.
Yeah, and the Samaritan had to have listened to the man by the side of the road. And one of the things we think about is when he's taking him to the inn, right? So he puts him on the donkey and takes him to the inn, puts him up for the night, presumably has dinner with him. That's a long conversation. And this is also part of Pope Francis's culture of encounter. So what they're trying to do, and what the Dicastery is really always trying to do, is to increase people's ability to connect with one another over various forms of social media. I thought it was great that they did it. I mean, I think it's very to the moment. It's a little long. I'm not sure how many people will get through it, but when you sort of meditate on certain parts of it, it really has a lot of richness for the reader.
And another piece of advice it has is logging off occasionally. So I'm curious, what's your approach to making sure you are not constantly online and detoxing from the toxicity of Twitter every so often?
Well, as we know, because we're doing this kind of professionally, you sort of have to look at this stuff. But I find that when I'm starting to despair or starting to get like depressed, I think it's time to log off. And I try to limit that certainly before I go to bed. And also, I try not to go down these rabbit holes of, you know, people who are attacking one another and online disputes and things like that. I find those are very unhelpful. So it's a kind of a little bit of a diet, right? You kind of have to sort of fast from social media once in a while. And I was happy they put that in too.
You know, this idea of being a neighbor, which is the question that Jesus is responding to or answering, you know, who is my neighbor? I feel like there was a shift in social media when we went from like, oh, this is cool, I can have friends online. And then there was a shift where it went from friends to followers. And now I follow people and now people are users. They're not my friends, which made it a much harder thing. It was difficult to yell at my, you know, my aunt on my Facebook page, you know, when the advent of this all started. But once we kind of shifted that way, I feel like things got more toxic and more contentious. In addition to like, and the document's not, you know, naive about this. There are media companies that are controlling these for-profit spaces. These are not like public goods yet, right? I don't know if you've seen that shift as social media sort of evolved and developed.
Yeah, and I've also noticed that it's different on different platforms. So I find, for example, Facebook is not quite as toxic. I think it skews a little older. Instagram, which Ashley introduced me to, is a little more benign. That can get a little crazy. But most of the time, it's people sharing nice images, and it's not so bad. Twitter, I think, is just a cesspool, right? And it really does kind of invite this sort of anonymous trolling. The document tries to help people with all those different platforms, and I think it does it well. But you're right. I think that there's been a shift in the last 5 or 10 years, especially on Twitter, and it's really gotten toxic and just kind of mean. And you really have to, as Ashley was saying, you know, you not only have to take a break from it, but you do have to kind of moderate your spiritual response to this. You can't let it in. You can't let it kind of grab you and have a hook on you.
What are the things I've like been most endeared to with social media are the opportunities to create these like little pockets of community, like real community, whether they're Facebook groups or I know that you've had some success with your like Friday face sharing groups. What has that experience been like? Sort of these like smaller communities as opposed to like the megaphone that gets blasted.
Yeah, that's
out.
Been amazing. So during the pandemic, I started this daily Bible study. I don't know how I did it every day. Well, we had a lot more time.
Yeah.
And we're up to like 1,000 people a day because, you know, obviously people didn't have a whole lot to do. But that was getting onerous. And then eventually, after about 6 months, I switched to every Friday. And it's open to everyone. But the amazing thing, Zach, is it's the same more or less 300 people. And I kind of know them now. So they all say hello at the beginning. And they pray for each other. One of the women, Ulrika from Sweden, just came by to visit. So it's much more relaxed because people know who everybody is and everyone's there for a reason. Sometimes you get a person who comes in and trolls, but pretty funny that everybody attacks that person. And then they say, Father Jim, you know, look what's going on. But it's much more relaxing. And I find I'm more relaxed in that setting because I know people are more or less open to what I'm saying, right? So it can still happen, but I think these places are sort of few and far between. Right. It has to be very intentional.
One last thing I wanted to ask is the media coverage of this document has focused on the fact that it kind of calls out bishops specifically. So having been a part of making the document, was that a very conscious thing that Pope Francis and the Vatican were trying to communicate by including bishops in the audience or people they're addressing this to?
No, in fact, I was sort of surprised to see that in the final document. I saw some drafts and that didn't sort of jump out at me. I think what they're trying to do is to say that this relates to everybody. It's not just lay people. It's not just quote unquote influencers. It's bishops and, you know, who sometimes, you know, can really be sort of kind of unpleasant on social media. One would be surprised to see that if you're not Catholic, you might think, oh, bishop, they would never do that, but they do. And so I thought it was good. I mean, it's they're part of the community too, and they have to listen as well.
Once again, the document is called Towards Full Presence, A Pastoral Reflection on Engagement with Social Media, out from the Dicastery for Communication. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Jim.
Pleasure.
And now stick around for our conversation with Bishop John Dolan. Joining us today is the Bishop of Phoenix, John Dolan. Welcome to Jesuitical, Bishop John.
Thank you, Ashley.
It's so good to have you, and thank you so much for joining us.
So you had the cover story of America's June issue. It was a ministry of fragility, how the church can support mental health. So we definitely want to get into that story, to your personal story. But before we get into the conversation, I wanted to kind of frame it in the question of how we should talk about sensitive issues like mental health and especially suicide, because there are more and less helpful ways to talk about these issues, and there are harmful ways to do that. And so we want to make sure we're avoiding that. So I wonder if you have any advice on how to talk about these issues in a way that doesn't increase stigma or put people at even greater risk.
Well, generally speaking, I would say talking about mental health is always a good thing, but obviously avoiding certain levels of judgment. And not so much judgment like in cruel judgment, like you're going to hell or anything like that, but sometimes just being prematurely judging why people have mental health related issues. And sometimes it might be, well, they're just not praying hard enough. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, maybe they're possessed, which is a very common thing now, especially I find among priests, that's something that they tend to lean toward, looking for the devil behind everything. And sometimes it may not, well, most often it isn't that. So I'd say 99.9% of the time, people who might even say that they're possessed have, maybe severe mental health related issues. So I would say that most of us, as human beings, we can be oppressed at times situationally, and some are oppressed all the time, but they're not necessarily possessed. And to me, I think that's a big piece of the puzzle when we have that conversation. And my whole thing is that when we communicate, we always remind people that they have a place at the table of the Lord, they have a place in the church, and they should have a place in society. And so anytime we can remove any of those stigmas of shame or guilt related to mental health, which is has no place, then the better we will be.
I think that's a good way to ground our conversation, some rules. Now, one of the first things you did upon coming to Phoenix was create this mental health office, this mental health ministry. Why was that so important for you to do?
Well, We, in San Diego, there was a director for our Office for Social Ministries, and he kind of leaned in that direction, and I can't remember why he did. Kent Peters, a very fine fellow, and again, it was not terribly funded, but he did his best to try to create this mental health ministry. It was basically a parish-based concept, so throughout the diocese, and hopefully parishes, his hope was that parishes would be able to pick these ministries up and attend to the people who were having severe mental health-related issues, depression issues, they had suicide ideation, and just to let them know, hey, look, we're here for you. We want to offer something. But it was hard because there wasn't a lot of financial backing. An opportunity to offer what we call first aid, mental health first aid classes, and so on. So when I came here and someone laid on us a huge gift and basically said, where would you like this to go? Which was just like, I mean, who does that? But at any rate, that's what happened. And at that point, I just said, well, first thing that popped in my mind was mental health. So that's kind of what happened. Of course, it's near and dear to my heart because I've lost, three siblings through suicide and a brother-in-law as well. So that obviously was the first thing that popped in my mind at the time. And so away we went. All of a sudden, we just took off and we have a wonderful office and a new director for this mental health ministry. And right now we're in the phase of just training. So we're training priests, we're training deacons, we're training religious and anyone concerned with mental health first aid, which is kind of a state-based program. And then basically we're sharpening the axe before we try to get out there and have these places of accompaniment for people in parishes.
I did want to ask you about your personal story, because I do imagine that is a large motivation for why you wanted to open this ministry. And a few years ago, I had an opportunity to report on the Archdiocese of Chicago's ministry to people who have lost loved ones to suicide. And the big takeaway I got from there is that, you know, this is a kind of different way of dying, and thus has a different sort of grief in the aftermath of it. And in your piece, you refer to yourself as a survivor, which is the same right. as all the mothers who I spoke to who lost sons to suicide spoke of themselves as survivors. So I'm wondering if you can help our listeners understand what this is like and why it's different.
Well, sure. I lost my first brother sibling when I was in eighth grade. So I had to deal with that as an eighth grader, as a youngster. And then I lost my sister and her husband when I was in the seminary. So a junior in the seminary, in college. And then my sister, my younger sister, most recently, last October. And so these different ages puts me in a place where losing someone, grieving over someone who had died by suicide, those ages mean a lot. As an eighth grader, I had no idea what to do with that. We didn't know how to deal with that. And then my sister dying by suicide in my junior year in college, that was different. It was still hard, but it wasn't our first rodeo, sad to say. And then this one, my sister Mary dying, I guess we all sort of half expected this to happen because she had attempted multiple times. And it wasn't a matter of if, but almost when. And I think we all kind of felt in a very weird way, kind of a sigh of relief, because I'd never met someone who wanted to die as much as she did, pretty much every day. So it's a hard thing. I miss her terribly, you know, but it's just, and you just leave it up to God. I think you just have to turn it over to God.
It's an incredibly difficult thing. I'm so sorry. And thank you for sharing with us. You mentioned in your piece, you know, being able to find support from your faith and the church as you're dealing with some of this grief. But I know, and Ashley knows from her reporting, that that's not necessarily always the case, that some people, you know, for some people, that's a place for them to turn. But other times, you know, you mentioned there have been gaps sort of in our pastoral care for survivors of suicide. Could you, I mean, maybe
right.
both like give your experience of it and then maybe some firsthand ways you've seen some of these gaps where the church has not done so well in dealing with it?
Well, I think it's not a surprise to you, but I think there have been sure. gaps in pastoral care in general. So, and this is just one more, you know, segment of those gaps. Obviously, when we're going back to those words of judgment or judging prematurely, like, well, there must have been something wrong. This person didn't pray hard enough. This person's faith was waning. This, if they just relied on God, or if they had just gone to the sacraments and things like that.
And are you hearing these things from like families or from clergy or from?
Yes. All of the above.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what did your tragic firsthand experience, how did that inform the shortcomings of those types of judgments? Like why they're not helpful, why they're not true? What did you see that kind of undermined that approach to looking at suicide?
Well, even as after my sister Mary had died by suicide, you'd get two forms of prayer. A lot of cards, really, of sympathy. And some cards most cards were, you know, we're with you, we're praying, and, you know, we trust that God is bigger than all of this and that she's with God. Which is good and nice. And then there were some, you know, we're praying that she's not in hell, you know, and they meant well. But it's sure that's like, those aren't the things you want to hear, you know. So I think sometimes we just kind of have people maybe make some assumptions and maybe based on their old traditional teachings that they had received, you know, like maybe this person shouldn't be buried. Maybe that person is in hell, you know.
Hi there, it's Ashley.
And Zach.
If you're looking for another podcast that features inspiring conversations with theologians, ministers, and pastors, then I recommend adding the acclaimed show No Small Endeavor to your podcast queue.
Each episode, host and award-winning theologian Lee Seacamp brings you thoughtful conversations with special guests, like the Queen of Christian Pop, Amy Grant, and pastor and theologian Tish Harrison Warren, about what it means to find true happiness and flourish in our everyday life.
As The Guardian said, No Small Endeavor is a must listen, and I couldn't agree more. So don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now, and tell them we sent you.
Maybe if you could just like outline some of like, because the church has changed the way it talks about and teaches this. Could you maybe outline sort of where it was and where it is now? Because even though it has changed, you, as you mentioned, right, some people are still handing down some of the old stuff.
Yes. Well, So I'm a co-editor on a book with a deacon, Ed Schoner. It was on a handbook for suicide survivors, survivors of suicide. So I had, you know, we had Cardinal Gregory and we had Archbishop Corleone, and they were all weighing in on this. And what was interesting, Archbishop Corleone, in his segment of this book, he shows us really what he calls a development of the human person, a development of dogma of humanity. And I said, he's absolutely right on this. We have come to see this development of the human person, especially now that we're able to look under the hood with new technology and see that, you know, our brains are actual physical matter, and it's not a mind over matter approach that we have to take to everyday issues. Sometimes the matter itself, the physical brain matter, is so affected that our level of culpability is diminished greatly. So historically, then the church has kind of evolved to this level where now we can talk about levels of culpability, and especially as it relates to, you know, holes in the brain and lack of blood flow and all of these different things that cause disorder.
Yeah. And this is reflected in changes in the catechism. It used to be
correct.
Suicide was always, it was a morally grave sin, and the updated catechism admits that there are circumstances that may reduce your moral culpability.
Absolutely.
And it's very interesting. You talk about how this was actually informed by science. It was the church taking into consideration what we've learned through psychiatry and MRIs and
all that
brain imaging. So it's a very interesting place where science has actually, as Archbishop Corleone said, led to the development of dogma.
Well, it had real effects, no? Because it was the case that you wouldn't be given a Christian burial if you had died by suicide. Yeah. And now, you know, church law, you mentioned in your piece, permits that. I imagine that itself had to be a huge, you know, pastoral grace for
that survivors. Oh, certainly that was, and I think our church is just moving us slowly to accept this reality that the brain is a lot deeper than we thought before. And I can't imagine how counselors, psychiatrists were able to address a person who had a mental disorder without the imaging that we have today and just in the last 30 years. So now we're able to kind of direct target certain parts of the brain are affected. And then we're able to, not me, but the psychiatrists are able to prescribe drugs that are a more perfect cocktail today than they would have in the past. It's really amazing.
So science and medicine have been able to inform the church's approach to mental illness. But I think what is clear from your piece is that, you know, not that it has its limits, but it has its lanes, and then the church has its own lane. And so I want to talk about your specific ministry in Phoenix and how, you know, you recognize the church's place as opposed to the place of the medical field.
Well, the two should be walking hand in hand or driving down the same highway, maybe two different lanes, but we're driving in the same direction. And I think that's a really important thing. And sometimes religion can get a little too far ahead. And so, you know, if they pray hard enough, then they're going to be able to deal with this. On the other hand, science can get too far ahead and say faith has no place in the field of psychiatry or the field of medicine in general. But so when they work well together, that's when we're in sync. And I believe that both, you know, it's our age-old Catholic tradition that faith and science lead to the same end, you know, God, ultimately.
And what specifically is the church's lane? As you're thinking, you know, as you're, you know, very much still getting this mental health ministry, you know, going, what are some of the things that you're hoping to do and not do?
Right. I guess specifically, you know, the Office for Mental Health Ministry is focused on educating. Really, that's a big piece. If we can just educate people about the science today. So this mental health first aid, which is kind of a state-run program, it really gets everyone up to speed on what's going on in the world of medicine in the psychological field. And then the other is the accompaniment piece. So we don't diagnose, we don't treat, we don't prescribe. And we make that very clear for legal reasons, but also just practically, all we're trying to do is fill in the gap. So let's say a person is seeing a counselor. We're there also there to kind of bring people together anyway, and just maybe on a Sunday or a weekday and with other people, and kind of offer that extra piece of spiritual care, you know. So going back to the issue of lanes, I think they do converge, you know, but we do know our lane. So we're not, the mental health ministry is not going to try to prescribe, you know, or anything like that.
But maybe this ministry is able to kind of refer out even, you know.
Oh, 100%, right? Yeah. And the office itself will make sure that the people that we have are properly vetted so that they are credentialed. Because a lot of pastors don't know that. And they'll think, oh, this person is a counselor. Somebody raises their hand, says they're a counselor, but they're not. Or they allow their credentials to lapse. Or maybe they lost their credentials.
So I even think how daunting it would be, you know, if someone comes to me in my own person, whether a friend or a family member, it's like, hey, I need help. I don't know where to go. Right. You know, I can be like, great, me neither. I will accompany you. I will walk with you. But right. If I had somewhere to turn that's like, that I just knew off the top of my head because I was seeing it on church on Sunday, it's like, oh, right. I don't know, but they do. Let's go.
Exactly.
Let's go ask them. I mean, that's a huge, huge benefit to the people of the diocese.
Yeah. And it's more than just even referring them to another counselor. It can also refer them to people in the parish. If you have a robust mental health ministry process, you can refer them to food sources like a food pantry. You can refer them to someone who might be able to assist them with taking care of their kids, babysitting services, all the different things while you're trying to just, you know, get your life together, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, you mentioned the word accompaniment, and you have this wonderful way of describing yourself in the article as a fragile accompanier. What do you mean by that fragile part?
Well, this is my take on life. And this covers every level, the psychological dimension, the social relational dimension, the physical dimension, the sexual dimension, our moral dimension. We're all disordered. I start with the idea that we're not a perfect people, but there's this perfect God who loves us and accepts the fact that we all start out in this disordered world. And God is always there. You know, I came to heal the sick, you know, not the healthy. And so if we all start from that level, then we're all going to be fragile accompaniers. If I'm pretending that I've got my act together and you don't, then I'm not going to be that great of a help. I'm going to be Pope Francis talks about spiritual direction or spiritual accompanier. And he prefers accompaniment versus direction, because direction kind of implies that you're already there and you're guiding a person to where you need to be, you know.
You know, you mentioned the ministry, the mental health ministry being one of accompaniment, but that seems to be where, you know, Francis is calling the church to sort of move in general, right? Outside of any one specific ministry, is this a church of accompaniment?
Right.
How do you see that overlapping with some of the other ministries happening in your diocese or in the future of the church?
Well, with the understanding that we're all disordered, if we all start from that level, then we should just be accompanying everyone, you know, accompanying the stranger. We're in a border state, so we accompany the migrant. We accompany people who are just trying to eke out a living. You know, I'm in a diocese where it's one of the largest counties and fastest growing counties in the nation. And with that comes a great deal of poverty, people living on the streets. How are we accompanying the people living on the streets? So Catholic Charities, St. Vincent de Paul, we have a magnificent St. Vincent de Paul program here. It's just huge. It's great. And it touches every parish. It's really wonderful. So I really think that accompaniment is exactly where we need to be. We're losing people in our churches. Because we're focused more on, you know, dogmatic teaching rather than just giving a glass of water to somebody here in the desert of Phoenix. You know, that's where the teaching should begin. So accompaniment really does begin, you know, on the streets.
And I think some people would be more comfortable or used to a language of service as opposed to accompaniment, because it implies like I have something to give you. You need my help,
right? And in some ways, I'm okay with that. You know, if people are ready and willing to roll up their sleeves and do something for another, I think that's probably a very good start. But
do you see a distinction there?
I do. Okay. Again, because it can come from that level of I've got these goods and I'm going to give it to you, and don't somehow that feeds my soul because I did something good, but I still don't see you. I haven't embraced you. I haven't accompanied you. I haven't looked at you as a friend in the manner of Jesus, who did that. You know, he walked with people. He dined with sinners. That's what he did. And he knew them by name, you know. And that's what we should be doing, you know, looking at the person.
You know, that is a Pope Francis quote right there, you know, seeing the person. And,
right.
And a lot of people are very on board with that. But some people, particularly here in the United States, are also a little skeptical or resistant to some of that change, right? I mean, some of that is just conversion is hard and painful. And other parts, there are like sharp and real disagreements with the program. Are you noticing that in your own diocese, or how do you navigate that? How do you sort of be a bishop of all people then?
Yeah, there on occasion I had some people who would just try to shut this whole thing down. They would just say, I don't believe in this. I don't believe in psychiatry or psychology. I think we can just, I'd get letters saying baptism and the sacraments, that's all that matters, you know. Well, in many ways, it is true, because if God is not embedded in our society, particularly through our sacramental life, then we should just close up shop. But on the other hand, if we can just keep educating and just be a mouthpiece for the people in the world of psychology, the psychiatrists, psychologists, they're loving it. That the Catholic Church is actually responding to their field of medicine, because it gives Catholics permission to seek out a counselor, to seek out a psychiatrist if necessary. So the more we talk about it, I think it's just going to get better. And speaking to the priests, especially, and the deacons, you know, they have a microphone every Sunday.
Yeah.
If you can give them that level of sensitivity and open their hearts to really understand the human person before they focus on the moral issues.
Yeah, that's something I have struggled with reporting on this, is the tension between not judging, not stigmatizing, but also not normalizing and ignoring the real pain that suicide and other things can cause in the lives of people around them. So how do you deal with that tension in your ministry?
I always like to start with, people might walk away from our moral precepts or our laws or their our rule of life. So my challenge is, then tell me, what is your rule of life? And let's see if you can even abide by that. And so then you start celebrating those little benchmarks where they are, and then walk with them as they might expand that rule of life to include, you know, better relationships with their families, better relationship with God, better relationship with the church, and so on. But you start where a person is. You don't let them off, and you celebrate their rule of life as they see it right now. And then, if possible, expand that, but at least keep them consistent, you know. And so sometimes you see that with people who struggle with mental health, that they're given up on God, they're given up on church, they give up on their family, they're estranged. You say, okay, well, tell me what you do have. Where can we begin? And you celebrate what they do have. And that might take months or years. And you start to expand that rule of life. And maybe it gets to a place where they can fully accept a lot of the things that we have within our church. But you just take them where they are.
Bishop John, want to say thank you for all of the work you've done in getting this ministry started, for the essay you wrote in America, and for joining us today. But before we let you go, we do have one final question for you that we ask all of our guests, which is, if you could canonize one person, living or dead, fictional or real, Catholic or not, who would it be and why?
Well, I would say one is on his way, I'm hoping. John Paul actually made him a blessed for sure. Blessed Fra Angelico. He's an early Renaissance painter.
Nice.
And what I liked about him was that he was able to take a point perspective, a linear perspective that hadn't been a part of the church or the art up until that point. And then he was able to employ a theological expression of that as well. So it wasn't just using the mathematical technology of 3D effect, but he was able to kind of create a theological 3D effect, which I think is exactly what we need today when we're thinking about the world in which we're living. You know, we need to look at things from a different perspective.
Do you have a favorite painting that you can point people to?
Well, of his, it's Our Lady of Cortona. Our Lady of Cortona. And there is, you'll see, in the very back, upper left-hand corner is Adam and Eve being ushered out of the garden. And up in the front of the painting is the angel Gabriel speaking to Mary. So you get salvation history, not from a left to right, but from a 3D perspective, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, that's a new one for us, I think. Saint Fra Angelico.
Yeah.
Bishop Dolan, once again, the essay is A Ministry of Human Fragility, Why I Established a Mental Health Office in the Diocese of Phoenix. We're going to link to that in our show notes so people can read it. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Yes, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, too.
If you ever need me, just call me. I waste no time, love. I come straight to you. Oh, the river's wide, dear, and the road is muddy. Even if I gotta swim there, you know I'll be there soon. If you would've told me your mom was coming, I would have worn my finest clothes.
All right, now it's time for parish announcements, the part of our show where we ask you to please be seated before the final blessing. Just wanted to jump in and say we really appreciated that conversation with Bishop Dolan. I hope you did too. If there's someone in your life who is struggling with some of these things and might want to know that the church is listening and responding, you know, I think this is a really good example of the church at its best. So consider sharing it and passing it out. They might be really happy to receive that from you. So just an invitation to spread the word about this if you can.
And then we have some bittersweet news to share, which is that our wonderful, wonderful production assistant, Kevin Jackson, is leaving America. Today is actually his last day. So we wanted to take a moment to thank Kevin. You don't get to hear his voice, but we couldn't make this show without him. And he has to put up with the rougher part of the show. He doesn't get the edited version of Zach and I, and he's very patient with us.
Yes, and also patient with the spills that Ashley sometimes produces from the beverages in the studio. Kevin, you've been a joy to work with as a colleague, and we are going to miss you so much. So thank you on behalf of the entire Jesuitical family for all you've done for the show and for America Magazine in general.
And now we have As One Friend Speaks to Another, the part of our show where we talk about where we're finding God in our lives this week. And Zach, I think you're up.
So I wanted to talk about the scripture reflection that I wrote for America this week. I had Tuesday's scripture reflection, and the first reading was from Sirach, which is full of some great advice. One of the things that Sirach says is that, you know, God delights in our offerings, our tithes, our sacrifices, but he explicitly instructs us to offer no bribes. These God does not accept. And it's like, okay, I appreciate that. But I also feel like I have some direct experience that is contrary to the idea that God does not accept bribes. And the person that I'm thinking of is my grandmother, who taught me how to do most of my praying. But I have witnessed her on more than one occasion sort of utter these things to God, like, God, if you get us through this drive when it's thunderstorming, then I promise to say Decade of the Rosary every night before I go to bed. Or God, if Scott makes the baseball team, then I'm going to bring the whole family to Mass on vacation or something like that, right? Like these sort of deals with God. Does that ring a bell or a type of prayer that
if you listened last week, you know I got lost in the desert and I was very much bribing God that if you just let me escape this wadi, you know, no more missing Mass ever, even when I'm traveling.
Right. And so I feel like, you know, some people might call that bargaining. Other people might call it bribing. I feel like anyone that's ever talked to a toddler and tried to encourage them or discipline them, no, that's a fine line between bribing and bargaining. And so I was thinking about this, and on the one hand, like, my brain knows that this is not really how God works, right? Like, God does not work like a genie. He does not, like, just make magic in our lives, and we don't have to, like, appease him with our little offerings in order to make that magic happen, right? Like, in some ways, like, God is going to respond with mercy and love and all these things without our response, with or without our response. But on the other hand, I think what's, like, behind that prayer that most of us utter in moments of crisis in particular are this, like, recognition that we don't have control. And in my grandmother in particular, there was, like, this trust that God would deliver and God would kind of come through with, like, mercy and faithfulness and love. And a response to that, she wanted to show gratitude for that. And I think that these are actually, like, really beautiful characters and qualities and aspects of relationship. And so I know that technically, yes, God does not accept bribes like that, but I also know that God can kind of accept prayers imperfect as they are, right? And be in relationship. And so I don't think that Sirach and I necessarily disagree about it. I think I just sort of like had to unpack some of the bribes that I've actually heard my grandmother offer.
Well, the reason God doesn't accept bribes is because he already wants what's best for you, even without your petty offering.
Yes, but
so that's reassuring.
Yes. The last part was like, I just feel like these are often at their best when they're on behalf of other people, mm-hmm. right? Like, because like when I was a kid, I'd be like, God, help me pass this test. And, you know, I'll say in Our Father or something. But I feel like they're
Your really. Grandma was a little less selfish.
She was a little less selfish than me. So that's what I was thinking about. So listeners, maybe that's an experience you have had in prayer where you have been backed into a corner and said, God, please get me out of this, and offered to do something in return and probably failed to do so. Or maybe you didn't. What was that like? And what did that really say about what your desires were and how your relationship with God works?
All right. I'll get us out of here. Jesuitical is produced by Sebastian Gomes with production assistance for the very last time from Kevin Jackson and Kevin Christopher Robles, who is also our sound engineer. You can follow us on Twitter at Jesuitical Show. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/Jesuitical. Please subscribe wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And if you're on Apple or Spotify, leave us a review. Jesuitical is recorded in the William J. Loschert Studio at American Media in New York City. For American Media, I'm Ashley McKinless with Zach Davis. We'll see you next week.
Have you ever wanted to dive deeper into Scripture? If so, you're in luck, because every day there's a new scripture reflection from the thoughtful staff at America Media, thinking through big questions together, like, what do Catholics believe about guardian angels? And what can Gen Zers take away from the Gospels? If you're already a subscriber, you can access these reflections in your email inbox or on our website. If you'd like to become a digital subscriber, it's easy to do. Just visit americamagazine.org/subscribe, and you'll have full access to America's scripture reflections.